Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. This is Terry Patton, and for anyone who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. This series was convened to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how higher consciousness can play a role in helping human beings to rise to meet our current challenges and make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. I've now held almost 90 remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers. Once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. Today, I'm joined by Bruce Lipton, and we'll continue that discussion in a conversation we've entitled Learning to Walk My Talk, How Quantum Biology Changed My Life. So the way this will work is I'll introduce Bruce, and then we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements, and we'll spend about half an hour taking your questions. So we'll be finishing up in about 90 minutes. Bruce Lipton is a stem cell biologist who was on the faculty of the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine for many years, where he did original research on muscular dystrophy, human stem cells, eventually producing some breakthrough studies on the cell membrane, which revealed that this outer layer of the cell is an organic homologue of a computer chip, the cell's equivalent of a brain. He later moved to Stanford University's School of Medicine, where his research between 1987 and 1992 revealed that the environment operating through the membrane controlled the behavior and physiology of the cell, turning genes on and off, presaging the emerging science of epigenetics. His deepened understanding of cell biology highlighted the mechanisms by which the mind controls bodily functions, and implied the existence of spirit. So he applied this science to his personal biology and his physical well-being, the quality of his daily life, his relationships, all improved dramatically. So he took his award-winning medical school lectures to the public and over time became a sought-after keynote speaker and workshop presenter. He's the author of The Biology of Belief, Spontaneous Evolution, Our Positive Future and a Way to Get There from Here, and The Honeymoon Effect. I don't have the subtitle right in front of me, but something like The Science of Creating Heaven on Earth. One of the things that I personally especially appreciate about Bruce is his warmth and enthusiasm and infectious vivacity. He's really alive. He loves people. He loves our potentials. I first met him in Colorado something like 15, 20 years ago, before the publication of his very first book, Biology of Belief. And I was struck even then by how immediately he electrified the crowd of scientists and researchers who had gathered at the conference where we were both speaking. At the time, it was striking in one way, but since then, I think Bruce has become happier and more energetic. And while hosting him at a wonderful event we had in the Bay Area just less than 2 weeks ago, and seeing what a great advertisement he is for his ideas, definitely taking his own medicine, I realized that one of the things I'm most interested to talk with him about is how he became so happy and joyful. So we talked about it, and Bruce agreed to make this his first public interview that will focus on his personal story of internalizing the implications of the ideas that he lectures about. So thank you for being with us here right now, Bruce. I'm so happy you've chosen to join me today on this program.
Terry, I am actually honored. I really so appreciate this because, number one, I really appreciate the audience that you gathered together. I love people that are thinking and represent really the cultural creatives, people who are thinking. To help us create a better way of life and evolution on this planet, looking outside the box, seeing better answers, and helping us get there. So I see your presence and what you offer as this opportunity for all of us to move forward with a little bit more positive nature than what we experience in life right now. So thank you for giving me a chance to speak with you.
Great. Well, I think it might be good if you could set the stage for this personal transformation by, before you even had this epiphany that changed your inner life so dramatically, your thinking had already begun to change quite a bit. And it might be good if you could briefly summarize these insights about cellular biology, you know, some of which you wrote about in The Biology of Belief, that led you to abandon a materialistic worldview and to leave your tenured university position to lecture and write.
Well, for me, it was an exciting and still everyday surprising consequence of watching the cells, listening to the cells, and learning from them. Let's talk about first, how did I get into the science? Because that was really a critical divide in my life when growing up as a youngster, hearing the words and the wisdom of so-called spiritual people. And even in my child's eyes, I can see, you know, something was strange about it. The words sounded so good, and the lives of these people didn't really match the words that they were talking about. And at some point, I felt a real disconnect between the concept of spirituality and life on this planet. It seemed like just a bunch of words. And at the same time, I was really gravitating towards science. I was young, and Albert Einstein was still alive, and I remember seeing him on a television when I was a little kid and looking at him, and I thought, something was so amazing about this guy. I think just the shock of white hair that shot out of his head and his ability to be himself. He was an independent agent in the world. He was intelligent, and he was science. And what I started to recognize at a very young age is that this concept of science was a worldwide understanding. So if somebody understood something in New York in a new science, across the other side of the world in China, the same science would be understood as being another valid offering and insight from that field. So that science seemed to be a global kind of agreement, which sounded much better than the spiritual stuff, which around the world was actually, in my vision of it, quite creating a lot of havoc. And so I dove into science and let go of spirituality and got into that whole story of dust unto dust, all that kind of stuff like that, and that we're here for a short time, we're genetically controlled, and this whole belief of the conventional world, and actually many people still conventionally hold this belief that we're genetic automatons, in some sense pre-programmed by the genes. Well, of course, I trained in that area, and I was then a teacher, a professor in a medical school, teaching about how genes control life and giving them the conventional understanding about Darwinian theory and all that kind of stuff like that. And, of course, that every book was the same story. And I was giving all that. And at the same time, I had the greatest opportunity in the world because I was learning how to clone stem cells from a master biologist, Dr. Erwin Konigsberg, who was at the time one of the very few people who was cloning cells and working with stem cells. So actually 1967, which is like, 47 years ago, I was cloning stem cells. And at that time, it was really interesting. It's like, well, there was probably a handful of people around the world that even knew what the heck a stem cell was. And I was working on the stem cell. So just to give a little background for those, for the people about what is a stem cell. Every day in normal life, we lose upwards to several hundred billion cells die every day. Normal attrition, normal aging, or from damage, or some experience that was noxic to the cells. Cells begin to die, so we have hundreds of billions of cells dying every day. Simple reality is, well, how many days can you go if you just have hundreds of billion cells dying and you're not replacing them? Well, obviously you can't survive. So the question is, where do all the new cells come from? And the answer is what we call stem cells. You say, well, what is a stem cell? And I go, interesting story. If I take a biopsy from a fetus a moment before it's born and show you a histological section, and I point out, I say, oh, yeah, see, this cell here is an embryonic cell. And it's interesting because if I wait a moment till after the baby is born, a moment later, I do the same biopsy, look at the same cell, and now I say, oh, no, this is called a stem cell. And so I just want people to understand, changing the name is because I can't call it an embryonic cell after you're born anymore. So a stem cell, by definition, is an embryonic cell, which is capable of replacing all the different kinds of cell types in our body that are dying every day. So I'm working on stem cells, and I'm teaching in a course in the medical students, I'm teaching the concept of what is called genetic determinism, which is the conventional belief that the public holds, and science doesn't really hold it, but the public holds, is a belief that the character of your genes will determine the character of your life from behavior to emotions to physiology to anatomy, that all of your life is some way pre-programmed in the genes, and I'm teaching that. And while I'm teaching that, I'm growing these stem cells in culture, and I'm cloning them, and here's what it means by that. I take one stem cell, put it in a dish all by itself, and it divides every 10 or 12 hours. After a week of cell divisions, I've got about 50,000 cells in the Petri dish. But what's most important is because they all came from the same parent, I have 50,000 genetically identical cells. So that's the start part of my experiment that I was working on. And then what I did is we provide what is called culture medium to grow the cells in. And culture medium is something we create in a lab. But it isn't just made up by randomness. The essential meaning of the culture medium is that it's a replacement or complement to the blood of the organism. In other words, the cells of that, wherever we get the organism from, rats, chickens, mice, humans, the cells grow in an environment that is nourished by blood. So when you want to take cells out of the body and put them in a culture dish, you create culture medium and try to replicate the conditions of the blood as close as you can so the cells feel more at home in a plastic dish. And so I have my stem cells growing in the main dish, and I have 50,000 of these genetically identical cells. What I started to recognize is when I was making up the culture medium, if I did some specific variations on some of the chemical elements, the cells responded in a different way. So I created, let's say, three different culture media types based on just changing some of the chemistry. So I put my genetically identical cells, split them up, put them in three different culture dishes, and I changed the composition of the culture medium, which is the environment the cells live in, a little bit in each of the three dishes. But what was surprising was in one dish the cells form muscle, in a second dish the cells form bone, and in a third dish the cells form fat cells. Well, what the surprising thing was about all this is that, well, all the cells that were used in the experiment were genetically identical. And yet one group forms, you know, muscle and another bone and another fat cells. And the question is, well, what control to determine what the cell should become? Well, the answer was clear. It wasn't the genes. They all had exactly the same genes. The only thing that was different was the environment. So here I am like, wow. This is totally amazing because here I am teaching the students, genes control life, and the genes control the characteristics. And in my laboratory, by observing the cells, it was quite obvious that the genes were not making this decision, that the decision was in response to an environment. And by changing the environment, I changed the fate of the cells. And really what became very exciting is a simple logical thing here is when you take a healthy dish of cells and move it into a less than optimum environment, the cells get sick and they start to die. And you would think, oh my goodness, your cells are sick. What kind of medicine should you give these sick cells? And the surprising answer is this. You don't give them any medicine at all. What you do is just take the dish from the bad environment, put it back in the good environment, and all of a sudden the cells get well again. So the environment was influencing the fate and development of the cells, but it also was relative to the health of the cells. In other words, the health of a cell and its characteristics were not dependent on the genes. They were reflecting what was going on in the environment. Changing the environment changed the genetics, changed the behavior, changed the health. And all of a sudden, it was like, wow, teaching a medical student's genes control life, walk in the laboratory and the cells are going, yeah, life is controlled by this environment situation. And when I started to realize this, I was thinking, oh my goodness, these experiments are repeatable. I can repeat them every day, get the same results every day. And at some point, it becomes really obvious is that what I'm teaching medical students is not really supported by the fundamental research on cloning these stem cells. And it got really difficult at some point because I was trying to understand the nature of this because it's hard. You walk into a world that says genes control life, and then you get an experiment that shows no, they don't. And at this point, it was like trying to encourage my colleagues to look at this research and think the way I did is that, wow, this is totally amazing. And my colleagues were all at that time very much wrapped up in genes because that was the big thing of the time, genes this and genes, power of genes, everything was genes. So here's my research that says, well, genes are not that necessarily important. And of course, nobody paid attention to the work. And it was really frustrating because it really revealed a new insight of the nature of how cells are controlled. And we might just take a little sidebar here, Terry, for just 1 second and go, people have to recognize this as well, that I'm working with cells in a plastic petri dish. And then people say, well, what is it, how does that relate to a human? And so let's just connect this to the human, because this is what I started to realize from my experiments in cells outside of the body in a culture dish. How does that relate to the body? Well, let's go back and understand this. When we see ourselves in the mirror, we see what we call a single human being looking back, a single organism. That's a misperception, because the truth is, underneath our skin, it's 50 trillion cells. Each cell is an independent living system. So a human body is not a single organism. A human body, by definition, is a community of 50 trillion cells. And I jokingly refer to this human body as a skin-covered petri dish. And the significance about that is in my skin-covered petri dish, I don't have synthetic growth medium. My growth medium is called blood. And then I started to recognize that it doesn't make a difference to the cell if it's in the skin-covered dish or plastic dish. The cell is still being controlled by the information coming from the environment. And then it was like, oh, wait a minute. Then the blood and the composition of the blood, the culture medium in the body, is what controls the fate of the cells. I go, yeah. And then the next step, of course, was to say, well, wait, who or what is in charge of the chemistry of our blood? What controls the chemistry of our blood? And then following this up the ladder, come to the fact that the brain is the chemist. The brain releases different kinds of hormones, growth factors, elements that control our emotions and things like that. So the brain is like the chemist creating the culture medium. So I really started to look around thinking, oh my goodness, here we are talking about genes controlling life, and basically I'm following the path back and it says the brain is controlling life because that's the one that determines the chemistry, which in turn determines the cell. So I'm starting to realize that this is a completely different understanding of the world than what I'm teaching. In fact, it was so disconcerting. At one point, even though I had tenure, I walked out of the medical school thinking, this doesn't make sense. And my colleagues ignored my work. They called it, you know, like artifact or a minor thing, not too big deal, because, again, they were so preoccupied with genes. So feeling like, well, I see this as one of the most major things. They ignored it. I'm in trouble here. And I left the system, and I started going out and trying to understand the nature of this. And that's when my awakening about who I was and my relationship to something I never believed in, spirituality, started to manifest its expression. So along this track, I'm starting to realize that the things that we were teaching in the medical school were fundamentally not correct, and we were misleading people. And the biggest thing for me, Terry, that people should understand is, with that conventional teaching, we are giving people information that they are victims of their heredity, meaning, oh, you got cancer genes running in your family, and you're somebody like Angelina Jolie, and you go, oh my God, I get this cancer, I'm going to have a mastectomy, well, I'm going to protect myself from this inevitable cancer that's coming on. And people have bought into the belief that genes control their biology, and if you buy into that belief, then by definition, you also recognize, well, as far as we know, we didn't pick the genes we came with, can't change them if we don't like the characteristics. And all of a sudden we realize, my God, the genes are controlling my life, and I don't control my genes. And all of a sudden that leads people to what medical students were teaching. We're victims of our heredity. We're victims of the genes we got, and we didn't pick them. And it's like, oh my God. So we're programming people to be victims, which immediately disempowers people, because they say, well, you have no influence over your health. The genes are doing this. And this disempowerment, unfortunately, as I've seen it over the years, is, oh my God, one of the biggest problems in this world, because when we give up control or power and we say, no, my health is not controlled by me, it's controlled by the medical doctor, because I'm the victim and the medical profession knows about genes, we give up power over our lives and we turn it over to other people. And what the results in the experiments were revealing to me was, well, wait a minute. If the chemical composition of the growth medium changes, it changes the fate of the cell. So therefore, if whoever controls the composition of the growth medium is really in control, not the genes that you got. And then, of course, it comes down to, well, the brain is the chemist, but then it says, well, the mind The mind is the interpretation. A simple reason is this. Cells are dynamic. They live in a world that changes all the time. Cells have to change their behavior as the environment changes. So the significance isn't how does the behavior, you know, how does the cell know what the behavior is? And by definition, it reads the environment. And therefore, it adjusts itself into growth or protection. And I go, well, so significant is then the cells are adjusting their genetics in response to what's going on in the environment. Fact. And then I say, well, listen, a human being, skin-covered petri dish, 50 trillion cells. I say, you got a liver cell inside. And it has to adjust its biology to support you in your environment. So you have to give information to the liver cell what's going on in the environment. Well, the significance is that's what the nervous system is for. The nervous system reads the environment, interprets what's going on through the mind. The mind is the interpretation. And then based on that interpretation, the brain releases chemistry to control the genetics and the behavior to keep the organism alive in the environment. So basically, when cells are in a, like an amoeba in a pond, it directly reads the environment, directly controls its behavior and genetics. But that liver cell that's buried in the center of my body can't read the environment. It truly just depends on what the nervous system is interpreting. It believes whatever the nervous system is interpreted from that environment and turned into chemical signals that control the cell. So the cell does not directly read the environment. The cell adjusts its biology based on the nervous system, in this case the mind, interpretation of the environment. So you could be living in the healthiest of environments in the world and you have a perception that this is a threatening, scary situation, then your mind is sending stress messages to your cells saying, get ready, be prepared, fight or flight, something's up. And in fact, it's not real. It was just what the mind interpreted. Well, that's where the nature of biology belief started to come in and said, your biology adjusts not to the real world. It's adjusted to your interpretation of the world, which in sense then says, well, what do you believe about the world? How do you see it? Because as you change the way you see the world, you change the response going to the cells. And all of a sudden, the biggest understanding, that's the most major thing, is teaching medical students that genes control life. We're teaching people that they're victims. Teaching people that how you respond to the world changes the genetics and behavior of the cell is actually offering empowerment for a simple reason. We're the ones that respond to the environment. We're the ones that can change the environment. We're the ones that can change our perception of the environment. Well, that what's relevant is then I'm not a victim. I'm the master. I'm the one that's sending the information. And if I know that, then I can adjust my biology with a positive response of my interpretation and not fall prey to that, oh, I'm a victim and things are out of control and they control me. So my whole life is going into all this stuff. And I'm beginning to see this and put it all together, and I'm starting to say, wow, if this is really true, then not just the behavior of the cells, but the behavior of the whole human body is really based on the interpretation that the mind is making about the world in which we live. And when I started to recognize that, I thought, well, then changing our thoughts and changing the way we live is a direct influence and a direct control on the health of my cells. And all of a sudden, this nature of mastery. And I got all excited by this, Terry. It was so like, oh, my God, this is completely different than anything anyone had ever been talking about. And I also started studying that cell membrane. And how does the environmental signal from the outside cross into the inside? And it turns out the cell membrane is an information processor. It reads environmental signals and then selects the programs that complement the environmental signals. So all of a sudden, I start to look at the body in a completely different way. It's like, oh my goodness, we control not just the biology of the behavior of the individual cells, but by our interpretation, we control our response to everything else in the world. And when I started to realize, I said, I'm not a victim. I am a master of this. I was so excited because it was like on science, on paper, there it was clear. This is the way life works. God, this is great. So, of course, the first thing I want to do was tell everybody. So I could gather whatever I could gather back in those days in the mid-80s and gather some people together, and I'd say, listen, I got to tell you, this science is really great, because if you understand the science, you could have this great life. You're the master. You can create health and happiness and all this stuff. And so I explained my lecture, and in the beginning, what I started to notice is that people would sort of like tilt their head and look at me sort of questioningly and sort of saying to themselves, you know, or to me in the end, well, that's a really great story, Bruce, but if that's true, how come your life doesn't look so good? And all of a sudden I had to reflect back on myself. I was not, you know, I was coming from my conscious mind. I was coming from my awareness. I was coming from my learning. And all of that made total sense. So I educated my conscious mind. It was totally great. And yet, in spite of all that awareness, in spite of all that knowledge, my life wasn't any better. I was still having the same issues with relationships and health issues and things like that. And it was sort of like, well, wait a minute. There's a disconnect here. There's something going on that doesn't make sense. I'm totally aware of all this science. So I have this, what you might collectively call positive thinking about life. And with all this positive thinking, with all this knowledge, I still have the same old life. And it was like very confusing to me at first, because it was like, how can you tell people that they can create the most wonderful life on the planet? And me as the teacher of such information is having this really not very great expression of life on this planet. The words didn't ring true. And that was real freaky. And there was a thing in one day that changed my whole life, and that was I had a pretty serious motorcycle accident in the Caribbean where I was teaching. And when the people found me, they brought me to the medical school, which was where the better medical doctor was at the time, those doctors at the school. And they were trying to help me, you know, bandage me up, put me back together. And I was like bent over, everything aching. My whole body was just out of order. It was just, you know, all crunched up in the accident. I could hardly walk. And all my fellow medical school teachers and professors and doctors could offer me were pain pills. Have a pain pill. And therefore I try and take a pain pill, and I'm, you know, hunched over Quasimodo, dragging my leg in pain. And one day a student shortly after said, you know, one of the medical students is actually a chiropractor, and he has a table in his dorm room, and he can do an adjustment on you. And at that time, I was being part of the conventional medical world, and everything I heard about anything other than allopathic medicine was considered fake or you know, quackery of some form. And so it's like, yeah, oh, yeah, chiropractic, right. And I was in a real bad way, so I thought, hey, I got nothing to lose. And I went to this chiropractor. And it's sort of being very curious in the beginning. It's sort of like, well, you know, show me something, demonstrate something for me that will give me some interest in your practice here. And that's when he introduced me to kinesiology, muscle testing. And the moment I experienced that, my life changed instantly for this reason. He said at first, hold out your hand, your arm, you know, and then he said, say your name, and then I'll put some pressure on your arm and you try to resist. So I, you know, hold up my arm, said my name is Bruce, and my arm was strong, you know, and I was like, yeah, sure, you know, no problem with that. And then he said, I want you to hold out your arm, but I want you to this time say that your name is like a woman's name, like Carol. So I thought, well, that's silly. Sure, I'm going to hold out my arm. I could keep it strong. I don't care whatever I say. And I held up my arm, and I said, my name is Carol. And all of a sudden, he pushed, and with the same pressure, my arm dropped. At first, I was in like a moment of like, what? You know, it's totally like that didn't make any sense. And I said to him, I wasn't ready. I wasn't something, you know, obviously I wasn't ready, so let's do it again. And this time, now I'm being more, you know, a little bit observant of what's going on. I hold up my arm. I say, my name is Carol. He pushed on it. My arm dropped, and I realized, oh, my God. It hit me, and it said, my conscious mind was willing my arm to stay strong. And regardless of my will from my conscious mind, when I said my name was Carol, my arm lost its power. And all of a sudden, it was like, wait a minute. My conscious mind is not controlling this. Something else is controlling this, has a different understanding than me. I'm saying keep my arm strong, and whatever is controlling it allowed my arm to get weak. And I was like, I was really stunned, because it was like something else is controlling me besides my conscious wish, which was keep my arm strong. And it was like, I'm not controlling myself with my conscious mind. Something else is more powerful that caused my arm to weaken in spite of my conscious intention. Well, this is a wake-up call of something about the power of the subconscious mind. And all of a sudden, I started to get into this, wait, I have a subconscious mind that what it believes is more important than what my conscious mind believes in regard to the control. And then I had to say, but what if, you know, what's in my subconscious mind? What beliefs might be in there that don't support my conscious wishes and desires? And that was the opening of this head. There are two minds operating this system. The conscious mind, which is connected to me, my personal spiritual identity, my uniqueness, the conscious mind being the creative mind. I was real excited by it. Okay, I have this conscious mind, but then I realized even if my conscious mind wished my arm to stay strong, it wasn't powerful enough to override the control of what I found to be the subconscious mind. If the subconscious mind has a different belief or a different program, it will override my personal wishes and desires that I carry in my conscious mind. And when I started to realize that, I thought, oh my God, then the problems that I'm facing are invisible ones, mainly in my life, in that my subconscious mind, if I don't have the, if we're not in agreement with the conscious mind, then my behavior and my biology and everything else is going to be controlled by the more powerful subconscious mind. Well, then I started to say, geez, what programs are my subconscious mind? Because I need to change these things, because if some of them aren't supporting me, then even with wishes to have something positive, it wasn't going to happen. And that led me to try to figure out what's going on, what's the story of the subconscious mind. That awoke me as I was driving to class one day to teach a bunch of students. I was driving in, and I stopped at a light. And as I stopped at the light, usually the radio's on or something, thoughts are running through my head, and they just run right through. But at this moment, I stopped for a second to listen to these thoughts that were going through my head. They were just streaming thoughts. Well, you're not going to get there on time, and this isn't going to work, and oh my gosh, you know, that program, that lecture isn't going to be this good, and all this stuff. And I'm thinking, what? I'm listening to this conversation going on in my head. It goes on all the time. We don't pay that much of attention to it. But at this moment, I'm stopped at the light, and I'm there listening to these things, and I'm thinking, my God, most of these things are not very positive with these thoughts. And that's when I started to realize that the streaming thoughts underneath that were going by when I wasn't paying attention were from the programs of my subconscious mind. And a psychologist had revealed 70% or more of these programs are self-sabotaging, disempowering, limiting. And I realized, oh my God, if I don't deal with these beliefs that are running through my head, then these are the beliefs, just like they control the strength of my arm, they're going to control the fate of my life. And that was the wake-up call, number one, that said, yeah, I got great wishes and desires, which are the character of the conscious mind's creative character. And yet I've got all these negative beliefs about things that are going to happen in my life, which are coming from some other source, which turns out to be the subconscious. And then knowing that the subconscious ones were more powerful opened the door and said, those subconscious beliefs, when you hear them in your head now, you have to pay attention to them and turn them around. So if I said, oh, I'll never make it on time, I'd have to say, wait a minute, yes, I'll make it on time. So my conscious mind was starting to listen to the subconscious thoughts running through and making a response to them and changing them if they weren't very supportive. It was the first process I did in learning how to rewrite the program of the subconscious mind through habit. Every time I would hear that same phrase come up and I would rewrite it with a more positive phrase, after a number of times of rewriting it, the mind learned through repetition not to have the negative thoughts come up.
Mm.
And Terry, this is so true, because a lot of it has to do with humor. A lot of it is humor. And basically, if I was to assess my psychological state back in these early days when I was working in a lab, and I'd have to say, to be honest, I was more like a manic depressive, in the sense that, boy, I had really good days, I was really great, but when things started to go bad, then they went bad everywhere. Whether what I was working on, it didn't make any difference if it was in the lab or I was at home. If I was going to a bad day, the next thing I would do wouldn't work out as either, and then the thing after that wouldn't work out. It was like a spiral. Mm-hmm. And when I would get into this, I started to see a pattern. And the pattern was, there'd be almost like a voice, like on my shoulder, someone talking to me like a parent or something, saying, giving me, oh, this is not good enough, that's not right, this blah, 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 all the negative things. And then my other shoulder was like me, like a kid going, come on, like this. And so it was just like being abused by this other program in my head. And so there I was one day going through this, and it was real interesting because I was trying to mix something in a laboratory that required the utmost exact measurement and very exact processing. It was adding an accelerator to a plastic to cause it to harden, and you have to stir it very gently. If you stir it a little bit too fast, the heat of just a little bit too fast causes it to instantly polymerize, and it takes so long to weigh it out. Well, about the fifth time of going through the whole process of weighing it out, and every time I do it, just in the stirring part, I would just, oh, I could feel that I would just lose it because it would start to generate its own heat. And I go, oh, no. And so about the fifth time, I was so angry, I threw this beaker of polymerizing plastic against the chemical hood in my lab, and there I saw the broken glass of the beaker drop down and the plastic oozing down the window, polymerizing on it. It was like that was the last switch of my depressive moment, and I got real angry, and I was really, yelling at myself like a parent. And it was so cool because there was this calm voice that I heard. It was like a third party, a distant voice. It was just quiet, looking at me, and I was going through this parent yelling at the kid, and the kid being, and I hear this voice, like a third voice, really. It's just like in my head. It goes, don't you have anything better to do than to listen to this stuff? And for that moment of clarity, I stopped this depressive moment for a second to listen to that, and I thought, yeah, I'd rather go to a movie than to listen to my art self argue with myself like this. And what I ended up doing after laughing about that, okay, go do something different. So I said, sure. So I went and looked up a movie and decided to drop this thing, go out, don't even clean up the lab, just go to the movie. And the fun part was when I got out of the movie, the depression was gone. And I started to realize that if I started to go into that depression again, I would laugh because immediately the voice would say, do you really want to listen to this stuff? And it was so funny. I laugh about it. And what happened was, because it was so funny, every time I started this depressive cycle going down, 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 as soon as I'd hear the voice, I'd stop. And I started to hear the voice earlier in the cycle each time.
Mm-hmm.
And a very short time, no more depression. Now you got Bruce, he's totally manic all the time, but guess what? The depression thing is gone. Why? Because when those self-abusive thoughts would come in, the reprogramming of the repetition of the statement, don't you have anything better to do, would kick in, stop it, and the program. And I realized, oh my God, I'm rewriting my subconscious programs, and started to get back control. And basically then got very excited by the fact that I was able to do this, and then started looking at the things in my life I wanted to change and looking for ways of changing it, and then really stumbling across the understanding that our conventional belief, which most people hold, that is that the two minds, conscious and subconscious, are part of the same thing, is not really true. They're like two independent, interdependent minds. They work together, but they are independent. And the problem that we face that I learned in this whole thing was, we've had this belief that if you educate the conscious mind, then by necessity, whatever you just put in the conscious mind should go down and load into the subconscious mind so that the subconscious mind has the same understanding. So we keep educating our conscious minds, but it doesn't do that. That's where the problem comes from, because in my studies, I started to learn that the minds learn in different ways. So the conscious mind, being the creative mind, was the one that was, in my life, looking at the cells and creating an understanding and generating a whole new concept of biology and how genes are controlled and all that stuff. And I educated the conscious mind, and not one bit of that education about self-empowerment in any way changed any of the subconscious programs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I realized the subconscious mind does not learn that way. And this is the most frustrating thing for most people, because it's like, I'm so much smarter than my life expresses itself to be, that my consciousness has all this intelligence. How come I'm always here? And that is because collectively there's this thought that just because we became aware of it, it automatically should alter our behavior around that topic. And that is when, no, it doesn't do that. And that's what caught me in the lectures when I kept trying to tell people about how powerful this was, and my own life was not an example of that at all, then how would anybody believe me? And once I started to do these changings, Terry, once I started to recognize, how does the subconscious mind learn? How can I rewrite the programs? How do I even know what the programs are? This was part of the evolution of trying to say, how can I tell people about this new science if I can't express it, then it doesn't mean anything. And the beautiful part was, along the trail, my life has changed so profoundly that the truth is, and this is so wonderful, and we didn't get into the spiritual stuff yet, but it was so wonderful because I started to realize I have power over the way my life unfolds based just not just my physiology and my health characteristics, but my behavior and what happens to me in my life. And all of a sudden it was like, oh my God, moving from victim into mastery. And the fun part about it, Terry, was as soon as I started to take this control back and my life started to get better, if I start talking about that thing to people, all of a sudden now they were listening. And they were listening because there's something that you can experience that makes it, the truth comes out of it. And I've been so lucky and endowed to have that part, because it was taking the science from the lab and saying, yeah, but that doesn't mean anything if it's just keep it in the level of consciousness. It's how do you take that science and make life out of it? And all of a sudden, my life started to conform to that. And today, I wake up every day on this planet and go, oh, wow, I'm still here. This is like the greatest thing I could ever imagine, being alive on this planet. And finding that my life has really upscaled itself because I started to remove those subconscious programs that were operating when I didn't see them operating. And now science has revealed that 95% of our life is controlled by the programs in the subconscious mind. And that subconscious mind, that's the first thing I understood through the kinesiology is, well, if that program in the subconscious mind exists and it's in contrast to the conscious mind, uh-oh, because the subconscious program is much more powerful and will win out.
And it sounds like you did something that is rare. Like your whole life was wrapped up in your communication about these biological discoveries, and you knew that you couldn't really do what you dedicated your life to unless you actually changed this. That you were very serious. There was no ambivalence. There was no, gee, maybe I'll try this out and maybe it'll work. It was a kind of clarity that was rock bottom. You knew that if you didn't make a kind of fiercely humorous, very happy, but still uncompromising stand to absolutely shift that unconscious negative self-talk, that whole negativity in your subconscious mind, that you couldn't really do what you were here on the planet to do. And you made that choice at a very deep level. And I think it's maybe not so common for people to get that they can actually make that choice.
Well, I agree with that a lot, because the hard part was, if you don't understand that the two minds are not the same, then it's confusing to an individual to say, well, I know this is the right way or what I should have done, or I know the correct thing, and my life ended up this way. My positive thinking, what happened to my positive thinking? It's like I have all this great vision of being healthy, and look at me. Well, if you can't explain that consequence, then all the science I was putting together was meaningless. How could you be powerful at the same time the life demonstrates that you're not powerful? That was the conflict. And so working on my own life was necessary to justify the science. Otherwise, nice words, Bruce, but they have no application to life around here. And to really be honest, Terry, I got nervous because I really stepped outside and was really the maverick out there. All of my colleagues shunned me, because back in the 80s or so, everything was genetics, and there I am talking about, well, genes maybe aren't that important. It's like, huh?
Yeah.
And it was kind of funny because I went back to the University of Wisconsin, where I was a faculty member doing this research after I had walked out when I had tenure and I left. Then I went into understanding to explain the science that I was seeing in the terms of the science that other people were dealing with. So I couldn't just say, hey, there's a whole new science over here, and people would why would they follow me? I had to make an understanding of it. So I remember coming back the first time to Wisconsin, and I needed a scientific audience. I wanted an audience because talking to lay people about this, it's like really, really interesting, but I needed a critical scientific audience to say, okay, good, bad, what's wrong with it, or whatever it was, because I was almost like insane. So, like insane people go out there and they're so sure of things, and everybody's looking around going, that person's really crazy. And I started to think of myself, am I crazy? Because I was so dedicated to this, I was so into it, this whole new science, but I had no reference of anybody saying, okay, that's a good idea or not. So I thought, okay, I'd go back to Wisconsin. The chairman was a friend of mine, and I persuaded him. I said, listen, I just want to give this presentation. I just need some feedback. And they gave me what was called a Wednesday lunch seminar, which is like, it's really a social thing where all the faculty and graduate students all come together and bring their lunch and hang out. And some guy stands up in the front. Whether he says anything or not is relevant or not relevant. People applaud at the end. They're not really paying attention. They're there for the social thing anyway. And so I figure, okay, well, any form, this will be good. I'll do that. I show up on Wednesday, and then the room fills up, and I see all my colleagues, my former colleagues, and all these graduate students in there. The room is packed, and I'm talking about this new biology, and, you know, and I'm like almost evangelical about, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever, and I'm talking about this, and right near the end of the talk, it dawns on me as I look through the audience that nobody's eaten anything. They're just staring at me with like saucer eyes, and I got this little edgy, uncomfortable feeling at this moment. It's like they're just staring at me, and I say, you know, giving a conclusion, and I say, thank you very much. And that dead silence lasted for eternity. They just sat there. They looked at me. Nobody said a word. And I was like, I didn't know what to do. They were looking at me like I was from outer space. And then I hear one guy way in the back clap. And as he clapped, he got two claps off, and all the other people turned and stared at him. And he put his hands down, stopped clapping. And like there was an invisible conductor, they all got up at the same time, and they all walked out. And there I was alone in the room, totally feeling, oh my God, I'm over the edge of sanity. I'm so insane, all these people walked out. They didn't stay to ask a question or a comment, nothing. They just left. And I got really, really scared, Terry. I was like, because why? I gave up my career. I'm out on my own. I'm doing all this stuff to support this stuff, and then come to this reality. Maybe I'm insane. Because none of my colleagues even stayed long enough to say hi. They just left, like flee room. It's sort of like, I guess, in the military when they cut your buttons off your coat. You know, you're now out of the military. It's sort of like they cut my buttons off my lab coat. I was now excommunicated from the system. Freaked me out, Terry, big time. And so on the last resort, I went back to where I got my PhD degree at the University of Virginia and met with some of the people on my committee who were world-renowned scientists. So I was really fortunate to get my cloning and stem cells and then have a committee of world-renowned scientists, one of the leading cell biologists in the world. And I thought, I have to find out from somebody, tell me where I'm wrong, so I can get off of this if it's wrong. I just need some science person to tell me where I'm wrong. And so I remember sitting down across the desk from one of the top cell biologists in the whole world, Lionel Revin, and he was on my committee. And so I said to Lenny, I said, Lenny, listen, here's my story. I want to tell it to you, and then I want you to tell me what's wrong with it. I just need to know what's wrong with it. So I unfold my little theory to him. And he sits there, arms crossed his chest, leaning back in his chair at the desk. And I finished, and I say, so what's wrong? And he looks at me just straight in the face. He says, well, it's not what we're thinking. I go, well, that's pretty obvious. I know it's not what you're thinking. Obviously, nobody's paying attention. I just want to know, what is wrong with this idea? There was a long pause. And all of a sudden he looks at me and he said, "It's too simple." And I bellowed out like an insane guy now, really. I laughed. I bellowed. He looked at me in shock like, you know, should he get some help here or something? Like, what? Why are you laughing like this? And I stopped and I said, "Lenny, first week of graduate school, you guys taught me something called Occam's Razor. And Occam's Razor is simply the simplest hypothesis is the best hypothesis and should be considered before all other hypotheses." And I sat there and I said, "If it's too simple, then that's the best thing you could have told me." And that then gave me the reinforcement to not be afraid and to go further with this. And it was really great because, in fact, it is the simplest hypothesis and made sense out of everything that they couldn't make sense out of. And that really gave me the courage to stand back up and go back and continue with this work. And I'm so glad I did because about 10 years later, science officially created a new branch called epigenetics, which is the science that I was teaching about what the cells taught me. So basically, the science of epigenetics, the newest edge of scientific inquiry at this moment, is the science that reveals how the environment and our perceptions of the environment control our biology. So,
sometimes it's the environment in a very physical sense, like the section of the embryo that has certain electromagnetic polarities creates the cell becoming a toenail, or an eye, you know, certain
it's amazing
eye structures. But in other respects, it has to do. So when you say environment, that's a very inclusive word, and it includes
it's very
things that are very
too.
Physical, and then also these belief elements that you're dealing with relative to subconscious belief patterns.
Right, and remember, the belief elements are an interpretation of an environment, and so it's not so your belief is not necessarily the real environment, but to your cells, that's all they see. So they buy your belief because that's the information you're sending them. So the cells don't see the real environment. The cells only see the story that you send them. So they adjust their biology according to your vision, but not necessarily the real environment.
So I suppose a skeptical listener would say, well, then are you advocating kind of detaching from reality and creating your own reality in a delusional way? And wouldn't the cells follow you down any path? So wouldn't crazy people be able to create, you know, inflated, I don't know, you know, bipolar, you know, biological realities, and what would guard against that? You've probably heard people challenge
that. Oh, yeah,
that
but
way.
I could give you a good reason for it, and that's why there's this common perception that we can agree on, and that is because my belief and your belief, Terry, they're functional operations of the brain. And what's really interesting is that we think, okay, my belief is in my head. I have my thoughts in my head. And in fact, if I put EEG wires on your head, I could read your brain activity, but that's because the electrical activity of the brain is conducted through the skin, and you can read it with a device. But we still believe, yeah, my thoughts are in my head. And I go, this is a belief. Because there's a new technology that's not electroencephalograph, it's called magnetoencephalograph.
Yeah.
And the relevance about that is the probe is not touching your head that reads your brain. It's on the outside. When all of a sudden it says, well, my God, if I'm reading your brain function out here, then by definition, your thoughts are not contained in your head. And when you understand that, then you start to recognize that, well, then everybody else's thoughts not contained in their head. And
right.
If you get enough people with the same thoughts, the entrainment of that same thought is a powerful field. The more people that have the same belief, the more powerful the field. So if you're in that belief field and you don't even have that belief, if enough people believe it around you, you will entrain to that. So let's say a pacifist is in the stands of one of those soccer games that always breaks into a riot, and the pacifist is sitting there, and the riot is going on all around them. They will be entrained to be participating in the riot, even though they're pacifists. And so basically, the belief of others really influence your ability to use your belief to fully control your life. So that's why it's important to recognize, to surround yourself with people that are much more similar to your wishes and desires of what you want for life, because their beliefs broadcast like a field. Like if everybody's head, think as everybody's head is a tuning fork with a belief, and it's a vibration coming out. And I say, if you have 10,000 tuning forks and they all hit at the same time, well, that's a heck of a vibrational signal. And if you're in the middle with a tuning fork that's not of the same signal, you'll be drowned out and ultimately entrained to the more powerful signal. So, if
yeah,
I
and you
to,
got into some of these ideas in spontaneous evolution.
Yeah, because we have to consider is a you know big issue, like you said. Well, if I want to wish myself to have you know wings, why can't I do that? And I'm going to say, well, that's really nice, but if everyone around you doesn't believe you can do that, then you're going to be limited in your ability. And it's interesting. I wasn't raised in the Christian religion at all, but it was an interesting story that Jesus could do miracles all over the place, except in his own hometown. And the reason was simply this, because all the people around there with tuning fork heads were saying, oh, that's just the carpenter's son over there. You know, who does he think he is? And the result is their lack of belief prevented his ability to create that belief from entering in the field. He was not capable of doing it. But if you go to some distant town, they said, oh, my God, the miracle guy is coming to town. And everybody's all hyped up because the miracle guy is coming to town. And the miracle guy comes and generates a miracle of some sort. It will be supported by everybody around because their tuning fork will be in harmony with that. So we have to recognize that, yes, we have ability to control our lives only to a certain degree, because we're also influenced by the belief of the collective. And that's where a lot of problems come from, because when we start to realize that the belief of the collective today is actually destructive of the world and we're in, science has recognized that human behavior is precipitating the sixth mass extinction of life on this planet because we're not living in harmony with the planet or ourselves. And then you start to realize, yeah, we want to get out of this problem. Then we have to change the thinking of a large number of people into another belief system. You can't create war or peace unless you get a large enough consensus of individuals that share the same belief. So beliefs are vibrational frequencies, and the more people that share that consider the same belief, the more powerful that vibration is in the field that will then manifest a reality that matches that vibration. So if we want to change the world, then we really have to look at individuals changing their belief systems and creating a different vibration and make it strong enough, and then it will manifest itself.
So this is really your response to the animating question of this series about how human consciousness can help us rise to meet the challenges of our world crisis is, in a sense, this building of this powerful vibrational frequency of a different belief pattern and living. Now, there's a practice, though, while we're something of a minority and not yet affecting the large-scale decisions of institutions and governments, we're still going to tune in the news and hear a lot of bad news. And the force of the negative belief systems of most people are going to be affecting us since we are so affected by the collective. So there's a practice of reorienting to a different belief pattern that, in a sense, we have even a moral responsibility to become capable of doing and to sustain as this shifts in a broader way. Is that the implication of what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely. You see, we've been through many different civilizations. They've come and gone. And we go over civilizations, you know, we can go back and we can talk about the earlier civilizations in the West being the indigenous people, animism. They practice a thing called animism, which every physical thing was also spiritual. And then later we went to polytheism and we put spirit into a whole bunch of gods. And then later we took all the spirit and put it into one god, monotheism. And then later with new beliefs, we let go of that monotheism and adopted materialistic science, today's version of our controlling, our culture controlling beliefs are coming from science. Every time when the population acquires a new belief system. The old civilization fades out, and the new belief system shapes the coming civilization. And as we've seen, over time, the beliefs change, and when the beliefs change, the civilizations with the old beliefs sort of disappear, and the new beliefs precipitate the formation of a new civilization. And today, this is part of the upheaval that we're seeing right now, is the beliefs that we've been living by for the current civilization now turn out to be very destructive. And as a result, civilization's falling apart. And what is this provoking? The issuing of new beliefs, the new beliefs that will shape us into a more, you know, positive future where thriving is really the seed and key rather than, you know, the whole idea of surviving, which is, you know, the threat that we face today because of our belief system. We've been programmed with a belief with Darwinian theory that life is, you know, this competition and a struggle for your survival because there's not enough for everybody, so you're going to have to beat the other one down, dog eat dog, rat race, that whole vision. That's a belief system. And we buy into it, and then we see, well, what is the result of all this competition? And the answer, self-destruction, and we're falling apart. You know, the beliefs of the time shape the behavior of the people. So let's go back to earlier Christianity. And it's like, oh, here's a witch. Well, what can we do to help the witch? We burn her at the stake. Because if we burn her at the stake, that will release the devil, and then she'll be a good soul again. So people, God-fearing, you know, normal everyday people on Saturday night say, hey, there's a witch burning in town, let's all go to town. And there was a big thing of, yay, we're helping this woman by burning her because her demon will be released. And people, families went to these things. Why? That's what they believed as a culture, and so nobody questioned it. And the fact is, yeah, but when the beliefs change and you look back on that and go, you mean there was a time where people actually burned other people with the belief that they were helping them? And we look at it today and go, that was kind of weird. And yet, some of the beliefs that we're entertaining today, in the very near future, people look back and go, you really believed you were that disempowered in the
right.
old civilization? So,
right.
Yeah. And so your show is very critical in this regard. Why? We must put the new beliefs out into the world so that people can entertain them. And if they start to really see, and it's an effective thing, and they change their lives, other people observing that will want to do the same thing. And that's how we move from one civilization type into another. We take along the things that were really good in the previous civilization, but we add the new stuff. And you've been a pioneer in the new stuff for years, Terry, and that getting that new stuff out is the way of surviving, because if enough people let go of the old beliefs and buy into the new beliefs, then the world that we're experiencing now will disappear and a much healthier world will manifest.
Right on. Well, let's get into that more. This is the moment, though, when I need to invite some questions. So if you're listening on your phone, you can press star 2 on your keypad, and that will raise your hand. And this is a time when I invite you, if you're listening on your computer, to type in any question you want to ask of Bruce. And meanwhile, I'm going to offer a couple of important announcements. The first is I want to make sure you know how to find out more about Bruce and his work. I primarily recommend reading his books. The hard cell biological science is mostly found in The Biology of Belief, although you'll find some of it also in Spontaneous Evolution, Our Positive Future and a Way to Get There from Here. And also The Honeymoon Effect, The Science of Creating Heaven on Earth. That's his newest book. Also, go to brucelipton.com where you can access a lot of excellent material, including a listing of his upcoming speaking events, including events that are coming up soon in Hayward and in Costa Mesa, California, and then in just a couple of months in Italy, Switzerland, and Denmark. Also, at brucelipton.com, you can join his online membership library for unlimited access to audio and video lectures, live interactive monthly membership calls with question and answer, and new content added each month. And I want you to be aware of some of my own offerings. I've been opening into something quite profound in my own practice having to do with deep trust and listening at new depths to the voice of my own soul. I've always recognized that there can seem to be two kinds of spiritual practice, one that opens beyond the self into love and freedom, and another that surrenders into the depths of the psyche, the natural world, and one's personal soul nature. But recently, as my own practice has taken a soulful turn, many new understandings about the relationship of these two dimensions of mystical life have been clarifying. So I've begun writing and teaching about it, and I call it integral soul work. And earlier this year, I decided to share that work with two small circles of students. And if you're interested to learn more, you can go to integralsoulwork.com. And if you sign up, you'll get a free download of the talk with which I introduced those groups. That's integralsoulwork.com. Also, there are some opportunities to work with me. Next month, I'll be teaching at beautiful Esalen Institute in Big Sur, August 17th through 22nd. There are only two spaces left, so if you're interested, you'd need to register pretty much right away. I'll also be teaching in September in Oslo, Norway, in Copenhagen, Denmark, and in the Wilderspiel, Switzerland. Something beautiful, deep, and miraculous has been occurring in my in-person teaching events. It's kind of a magical time, so you're warmly encouraged to join me for one of those. You can find out more details about all these events by going to terrypatton.com, and I encourage you to sign up for my mailing list there. It's a little different from the mailing list for Beyond Awakening, so you're invited. You may not be on that list. If you click events, you'll find out more details and registration for these. Also, at the end of this call, I'll tell you about what's coming up on Beyond Awakening. Now, let's take a look at the questions that have come in. Well, there are quite a few typed questions. Let me invite here's somebody who's raised their hand. I don't see a name on this. Please speak up if you raised your hand.
Thank you. Thank you both very much.
Hi. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Marie.
Hi, Marie.
Hi, Marie.
Thank you. Regarding walking our talk and our creative power used wisely or not, Bruce, regarding how can we reconcile the rich information you've shared and awakening to the sacredness and interconnectedness of all that exists at all levels with the increasing use and addiction and heavy marketing of the man-made radiation technologies and devices and their impact and potential future consequences, specifically the frequency-altering cell phones, Wi-Fi, and so-called smart devices that have been scientifically proven to alter environments and negatively alter and damage cells of living things on the microbes, human, plant, and animal kingdoms?
A very important question, Marie, and it's very interesting because the answer really has to do with the fact of our own level of stress. And it's very critical. There were studies, for example, we all are aware that what about the high voltage and the EMF fields underneath the high tension lines and all that? People have been talking about that for years, and then they always get different kinds of results because a lot of people are not affected by it, other people are affected by it, and they're trying to, you know, figure out what is there anything real. And now the answer has really come clear, and that is simply this: we are energy beings, number one. And we can see these energy fields using different kinds of techniques like Crowleian photography or gas chromatography. These different techniques are seeing a field around individuals. The relevance of the field, and especially you can see it in Crowleian photography, is when there's a weakness, the field strength gets smaller and there are holes in the field more or less. And you can see that. Well, this turns out to be the connection to when people have problems with electromagnetic fields. Those people that are susceptible and end up having illness that result from it, collectively were stressed people. Those that people that were not under stress were resistant to the influence of these exogenous energy fields. This becomes really critical because if everybody was just going to be, you know, affected by this, then we'd have a very serious issue on our hands. But if we start to find there are people who are totally resistant to this, then we have to understand what makes that resistance. And then we start to see that protection, which is around us, and spiritually people talk about surround yourself with white light. Well, really, it's really making a sphere of energy. And the stronger your energy field, the less things will come in and interfere with it, to the extent you can walk across hot coals. That energy field will resist the heat of the hot coals. But if you have a disbelief in that moment you're walking across the coals and you just have a question, can I do this? At that moment, you'll burn yourself because the field breaks down. And so basically, and another one, just because it's, you know, people know about walking across hot coals, really, if it's in your belief system, do it. And if you don't believe it, then I really wouldn't do it because you're going to get burned. That's a fact. And you say, well, what was the difference? And I would say, there's a field that protects you. And it also protects you. And this is really, I use it because if you understand the meaning of it, it's extremely powerful at many levels. And it's this. Down south, we have some fundamentalist religious people that work themselves up into a state of religious ecstasy. They start speaking tongues and doing weird kinds of things like that. But they do something called testify. And testify means they do something that no ordinary person in their right mind would ever think of doing. And yet they say that God will protect them from this strangeness. So many of them are snake handlers. Interestingly enough, just a couple of weeks back, one of them died. But most of the time, they get bitten and they have no problem. That's not the one I want to talk about. I want you to think about this for a second. Many of them testify that God is powerful and protects them, and they drink strychnine poison in toxic doses, and they have no harmful effects. And this becomes extremely powerful as a teaching tool if you can understand what the meaning is. And the meaning is they have an unshakable belief that God protects them. So when they drink the strychnine poison, it's like walking across the hot coals. It doesn't penetrate into their body. It doesn't go there. And when you say, well, wow, and I go, yeah, it's a little bit more than wow. Because it says, we have acquired a belief, which was starting with the genes controlling your life and then bacteria and germs controlling your life and all these other things. And people are going, oh, my God, I'm vulnerable to all these things. And it's like, no, we're not. We're only vulnerable if, A, we believe we're vulnerable, and, B, we're under stress. And therefore, when these religious people in their state of exhilaration under that belief and working themselves up, they drink this poison, there is no effect because it doesn't go into their field. And we have to understand that. Well, I'm not suggesting we go out and drink poison by any means, but I want you to understand is the power of mind. When we are programmed to be weak, when we're programmed to anticipate, oh, my God, you're living in these fields, and you know what fields do, and you believe that, then by definition you've perforated your field, and those things will come into it. And the study under the electromagnetic fields line revealed simply that by looking, A, the perforation seems to be greater when we're under stress. So you have two choices. You get rid of all the electromagnetic fields, not likely. But on the other hand, we start to see that we're a lot more powerful than our belief systems allow us to be. We have been programmed to be weak and powerless. And the fact is, no, we are not. We are so powerful that it's hard for us to even entertain how powerful we are. One of the other things I show in the class, which makes people stop and think about how powerful we are, is I show a number of newspaper articles reporting exactly the same thing all over the world about like a car accident and a child caught under the car and the mother lifting up the car to free her child. Well, it's like, well, you say, well, that's pretty interesting. I go, I show pictures in the class of these muscle-bound weight lifters sweating as they're trying to lift up a car, and then there's this just frail housewife mother lifts up the car because her child's under it. It's based on the belief system. If I asked you right now, go out and lift up your car, you'd say, I can't lift up a car. Well, right away, then the answer is no. But when your child is under the car, the answer that I can't lift a car is not really satisfying. At that point, the belief system, just like the surety of the belief system that drinks strychnine, will reveal how powerful you are because you can lift up the car. And why I'm bringing that up is, excuse me, as our perception of being weak And therefore, we look around us and try to explain why all these things on the outside are causing us problems. And the fact is, that's not where the real problems come from. Well, I got a moment here. I just add this to Marie's question, is the concept of genes. We bought into belief that there are cancer genes. And people believe, well, I got the cancer gene, I'm going to get the cancer. And then we have someone like Angelina Jolie have a double mastectomy because she's afraid she's going to get the cancer because the genes control her life. And the simple reality is a misperception that has been generated to the public that genes cause this cancer. And the answer is no, genes did not cause that cancer. And the simple understanding is this, 50% of the women with the BRCA1 gene, the cancer, so-called cancer-causing gene, 50% of the women that have the gene never have the cancer. And you have to say, well, wait, we only talk about the ones that got the cancer and they got the gene. And we never talk about the ones, yeah, but 50% of the women have the same gene but never get the cancer. What's the point? The point is we have been, you know, empowering the gene that causes cancer. It's like the gene didn't cause cancer. You know, that's what 50% of the women have the gene. They don't have the cancer. So all of a sudden we have to stop looking at the frailties that genes provide, or for our belief that how powerful things are, so-called powerful outside of us, affect us, because that is a belief system that ends up disempowering us, makes us vulnerable, because if you believe you're susceptible, then your mind will manifest a state that matches the belief. To close this, because it really is based on all of this, what I came to understanding about the mind, the function of the mind, this is so cool, the function of the mind is to create coherence between what you believe and the reality that you experience. That way life makes sense. Geez, I believe that would happen, and it didn't. It's like, yeah, see, I thought so, now that makes sense. So basically, if you believe you're frail, then the mind will create a physiological system that will reveal your frailty. And if your mind is strong, walk across the hot coals, drink the strychnine poison, lift up the car, and you realize, oh, yeah, it wasn't the body's frailty, it was our perception of frailty.
And yet we have to learn how to transform our beliefs in a way that is sustainable, and we need to understand our capacity and not get beyond it. We could, a naive person could get inspired by these ideas and drink strychnine before they're able to actually deal with it. And so there's a kind of deep wisdom that where we can learn to apply this in a truly managed and sustainable way. Several people typed in questions about Parkinson's and cancer and other specific maladies. And I it's clear that your response is yes, your beliefs can affect any of these conditions.
Let me just, because you brought up Parkinson's.
But you, not a naive kind of this has to be at a very deep level for it to be really
effective. Absolutely. Yeah, and this is, and so it's very important to understand this. Parkinson's, people with Parkinson's disease show a very positive effect to what is called the placebo effect. In other words, when they're testing new Parkinson drugs, they always have to throw in a sugar pill to show that the sugar pill didn't really do anything, but the drug really did something. And what they turn out is that 20, 30 or more percent of the people have a very positive effect, even with Parkinson's, when they take the sugar pill. Why? Because they believe that the pill was going to heal them. So what healed them was not the sugar pill, for sure. It was the belief in the healing, and that's the consequence of the placebo effect. And why I say that's important is, well, if John Doe over here has Parkinson's and he changes it and gets healthy because he changed his belief, you are the same biology. And you have to recognize then the limitations that we have. And unfortunately, again, it's a belief issue, especially with cancer. Less than 10% of cancer is actually due to heredity in the first place. Cancer is due primarily to lifestyle and beliefs. And the significance is very profound, because when we believe you're going to have a cancer, you're opening up the mind. Remember, the mind is to create coherence between your belief and the reality. The stronger your belief you're going to have the cancer, the more you will actually manifest the cancer. The stronger your belief you are powerful and can avoid it, then the more you avoid it. So we keep looking in our material world at, oh, the cancer is due to the genes. The illness is due to the vibration and all that. And we have let go of what is the power of thought and consciousness. And we are so powerful, but there's a very interesting point. We have collectively been programmed to be disempowered by those that have the power. And it's interesting because this power belief has been known for 500 years, the influence of it, you know, and it really irritates me because the Jesuits boast, they say, give me a child until it's six or seven, and it will belong to the church for the rest of its life. Well, we now know the first 6 or 7 years of your life is programming. So if I program you, as they were saying, then I will control the program irregardless of what your wishes and desires are. That turns out to be the truth of what biology of belief is all about. That is the boasting of, yeah, give me that child for 6 or 7 years, I control it. And the fact is, yes, you do. And the issue is then we say, well, let's go back and look at those beliefs. And I already brought up the percentage was 70% or more of the downloaded beliefs that we acquire during our developmental period before seven. 70% or more are negative, disempowering, self-sabotaging. So there you can see where's your problem. And just to tie it up, to make it a little bit tighter package, our conscious mind, the creative mind, has wishes and desires. That's the one that says, I'm going to be healthy, I'm going to find a relationship that's great, I'm going to have a great job. And I go, that's great. And then I have to tell you, and this is what's in the book that comes out that I learned, only 5% of our life is controlled by the conscious mind's creative aspects, such as wishes, desires, aspirations. Only 5%. 95% of our life is controlled unconsciously by the programs in the subconscious mind. Well, when you understand that 95% of your life comes from those programs, and then you take into consideration the psychologist telling us that 70% of those programs are disempowering and negative, then you start to realize, oh my God, I am not running my life with my wishes and desires. That's what the initial thing we talked about with the muscle testing. My wishes and desires come from my conscious mind. My conscious mind says, keep your arm strong. And I go, yeah, great. As much as I was intending to keep it strong, it fell. Why? Because more of my life is controlled by the subconscious program. And therefore, we have to recognize that we are powerful. We are so powerful, except we don't believe it. And therefore, and it's interesting, again, not being a Christian, but growing up in a predominant world expressing that, and then hearing consistently from the scripture people saying, oh yeah, Jesus did all these miracles, and he said, you can do these and more, even better than I can do them. And somewhere along the line, those are like trite words because people say them, but then why don't we manifest them? We can do it. It was said you can do it. And the answer is because your programming has disempowered you. And that's given.
So this matter of changing that programming at a deep level is something that you've taken very seriously. You've changed your life in dramatic ways. But it sounds like you take it so seriously and you see how profound it is that you see that it can go further, that even to the degree that you've changed your subconscious programming, there's still room to do more change, that this is something you practice with as an ongoing aspect of applying what you've understood. Is that accurate?
That is accurate, Jerry. That's totally accurate because every day, you know, look, how many programs did we acquire before age seven? Thousands of programs of how to deal with life. That's where a child gets an education of how to be a functional member of a community or a family or a society. How do you become a functional member? We got to learn all these thousands of rules. And I go, well, how does a child learn it? And in my book, I describe that the subconscious mind is in a state of hypnosis for 7 years, downloading other people's behavior. So therefore, you learn every nuance of life by observing your mother, your father, and your family, and the community around you. How you talk to another child is different than how you talk to an adult, which is different than how you talk to a policeman. Every little nuance is a program. And so while you may start to work on a number of major programs, hey, we got thousands of programs. So if you think you've done it, then you're not really there. I'm not walking on water for sure. But the reality is I'm much closer to it all the time because once I start to identify any limiting or you know issues that are blocking me, I've learned how that you can rewrite them. And that was the big learning, Terry. That was the most major thing. And I said, the problem that we have bought into is that both minds are connected, so that, oh, I educated my conscious mind, and now, by definition, my subconscious mind should have the same knowledge. And the answer is no. They learn in different ways, and that has been the biggest problem we have on the planet, because my conscious mind is unique. It's creative. It can learn from listening to the conversation we're having here. It can learn from reading the self-help book. It can learn from the videotape. It can go to the lecture. It can just even go, aha, and the conscious mind learns because it's creative. The subconscious mind is not a creative mind. It's a habitual mind. It has habits in it. And it's not a bad mind or a good mind. It's just a device that stores habits. Now, the habits might be good or bad, but the subconscious is not good or bad. It's actually quite necessary. You learn how to walk. Now it's a habit. What's important? You don't have to relearn this every day. And it doesn't change easily, because that's what's neat about a habit. If you learn it right the first time, it will always repeat this exactly the same. And so I say, well, I educated my conscious mind by listening to Terry and Bruce on the radio. And I go, now should my life after the show is over, my life will be different because I have this new education. I go, no, it won't be necessarily, for the simple reason is this. Your conscious mind can pick this up in its creative understanding and listen to things we're saying and create knowledge out of it. And I say, yeah, but the subconscious mind learns in three or four fundamental ways. The first 7 years it learned, because the brain function of a child through first 7 years is predominantly called theta, and theta EEG behavior is hypnosis. So you don't have to teach a child. All it has to do is observe you. A child observes you and downloads the behavior just through the observation, 7 years. After you're seven, you start expressing consciousness in your brain. The frequency goes up. It's higher. It's alpha. It's now presenting consciousness. Well, the significance about that is the first 7 years then were downloads, hypnosis and theta, which gave us programs. And then after we're seven, we start exercising consciousness. But the subconscious can still learn things. I said, well, how did you teach the subconscious after you were seven? And the answer was repetition, practice, repeating things until you get it done. How many times did you say ABC until you finally could get the Z? And then you get the Z. Now, guess what? It's in the program. You never have to worry about it again. How many times, the times table. You had to repeat the times table. And then you repeat and repeat. And guess what? Now, after you repeat it, it's a habit. And now it's in your head forever after that. Driving a car. You had to learn. You had to practice. And now it's in your program. So subconscious mind primarily learned in the first 7 years hypnosis. Second, after seven, it learns by repetition, the creating of habits. A third way, which is not controllable, is a shock to the system can almost instantly rewrite a subconscious belief. A doctor tells you got a terminal illness. That frequently causes people to all of a sudden rewrite their subconscious programming like in that shock. But you can't control that. The third real way of controlling it, first being hypnosis, then repetition of habituation. And the third way of changing it is something called energy psychology, which is engaging a super learning process. And this is really exciting because this is the newest front of how to change belief systems. And you can change beliefs you had your whole life, 50 years or more, in 10 minutes. Because there's a new understanding about how to directly affect the subconscious mind. And we didn't know that. So up to now, what do we say? Well, if I educate my conscious mind, my subconscious mind will learn. And I go, no, failure. You read all the self-help books and your life is still pretty much the same anyway. And there all of a sudden I say, but there are other ways of doing it. And because subconscious doesn't learn from the reading or watching or viewing. It learns from hypnosis, habituation, and a process called energy psychology, which engages super learning. And that's how you educate the subconscious mind. So your conscious mind first acquires knowledge. Oh, this is how it works. And then the next exercise is dependent upon you, which is what I learned. Okay, this is how it works. I said, the universe works. I got the machinery. I understand the whole thing. But until I educated my subconscious mind, that information did not alter the behavior I had before I had this awareness. And so basically, it's a two-step process. A, educate your conscious mind, become aware of what it is, and then B, change the subconscious program, hypnosis, repetition, super learning, and rewrite the program. And therefore, then you can now put a program in that supports you 95% of the day than the conventional programs we acquired that generally sabotage us.
Well, Bruce, there are so many cool questions here that I have not had a chance to ask. I just want you to know there are questions from Australia, Peru, all over the United States, questions about different practices, questions about different maladies, questions about psychoanalysis, about shamanism, really rich questions I would have liked to have asked. Maybe there's one that I can try to squeeze in. We're going over time a little bit, but
let's try one more shot, Terry.
This one intrigues me. There was a question about Vipassana, and also Peter in Beverly Hills asked about devotional non-duality, which I can explain to you. It's something that I'm steeped in, which is that essentially recognizing that there really is only one, that at the deepest root we're all expressions of a single conscious, you know, non-duality, not two-ness, the heart can open in loving contemplation of that, so that life of a deep practitioner of devotional non-duality is kind of constantly opening oneself into loving contemplation of the one who is being me and all things. And that recognition in every moment of the nature of anything you're seeing as being an expression of the consciousness with which you're seeing it, which is your very self and with which you are in love. And this is, in many people regard this as kind of the highest of all spiritual practices. What is the potential of that to reprogram the subconscious? What's your perception of how these really high spiritual practices might relate to the kind of things that you've been telling us about?
Well, it's really critical to me because, as I said, when I first started all this, I wasn't a spiritual person. When I started to understand the nature of how cells worked and the membrane was this information processor, I saw at that first time, and I recognized it because I was also doing work with transplanting tissues, is that our cells have an identity to them. So, Terry, you put your cells in my body, and Bruce's immune system says, not Bruce, and eliminates them. I put my cells in your body, so Bruce's cells are in there, and Terry's immune system looks at them and says, these are Bruce's cells, these are not my cells, and gets rid of them. So the first thing I understood was all of us have an identity built into the cells. When I started understanding the nature of the identity, I saw that it was a set of antennas, protein antennas that receive signals on the surface of the outer surface of the cell. That if I take these antennas off the surface of the cell, it loses identity, it becomes generic. When you put the surface antennas back on, it requires a unique identity. What blew my mind was, well, wait a minute, the antennas are receiving a signal, but their location on the outside of the cell really revealed that the signal is coming from the environment. And that's when my whole life changed, because I recognized that my identity was not in here. I am part of a field on the outside. And my cells, having a a different combination of antennas, picks up what I call like the Bruce show. Terry, right now, your cells are picking up the Terry show. Each one of us is picking up our own show. But what was really interesting about that in a couple of minutes, because it's so profound, was number one, the moment I recognized that, I said, oh, my God, I'm immortal. The reason why I said that is, if my identity is coming across these antennas and being picked up by the cell, if the cell dies, it doesn't change the environment. The environment's still there. It's sort of like the story of the analogy of a television. You're watching a television show, and the television breaks. Say the television's dead. And I go, yeah, the television's dead. Did the broadcast die? No, the broadcast is still there. Get another TV, tune it to the right station, boom, it's back online. And all of a sudden I realize, A, I couldn't die because I'm not in here. B, I could come back in a future body if the body has the same set of antennas on its cells that my cells have, because my identity is being picked up from the outside. And so reincarnation and all that stuff. But the basic fundamental understanding is, but we all came from the same source. And so all of us it's sort of like looking at a radio, and you got the whole band, and we say, yeah, this is the FM band of the radio. All the stations are on here. It's all one FM band. But if you tune it to this one, you get this station. If you move it a little bit, you get this station. It's just a little piece of the whole band. Each one of us, as I see it from the receptors that give us our self-identity, that these receptors are scanning the same field, but each one of us is getting different information out of the field. And all of a sudden it's like, A, we're not in here. B, we step into this biology. And as long as the cell's alive, I am focused my energy into this body. But when I die, the energy is still out there in the field. And if another body shows up, and then I start to recognize this, and all of a sudden I realize, well, I'm spiritual. I'm the physical body you see, but the broadcast is coming in from outside. And all of this changed my entire life because, I'm a different person than you are, and we're all different. In our Darwinian theory, we compete against each other because that's the thread of survival that we've been, programmed to express. And then all of a sudden I start to realize, wait a minute, we're all part of the field. We're all part of the same field. We're just different. It's sort of like the rainbow spectrum. You put white light through a prism and it breaks up into the spectrum of the rainbow. And I go, okay, what happens if you take the spectrum of the rainbow and push it back to the prism? I said, it comes out white light. So basically, each one of us is like a piece of the white light, a different color frequency. So imagine this whole spectrum of the rainbow made out of millions and millions of different slight changes in the frequency of the color. Each color is a different frequency, but all of the color came from the white light. And that's when I started to recognize our antennas are unique to pick up a special frequency out of the white light. But by definition, we all came from the white light. And therefore, if you say to, and when I give the lecture and I show the slide and I say, yeah, here's the white light comes into prism, breaks up into the spectrum of the rainbow. And then I say, what if we took one of the smallest frequency out of the rainbow, threw that frequency out and say, we don't like this frequency. It's not part of us. I say, okay, take the remaining colors of the spectrum, push it back through the prism, and guess what? You don't get white light anymore. And what I started to recognize is, oh my God, each one of us is a piece of the white light, but collectively, all of us are the white light. And so, a lot of old religions suggest that an individual, another Jesus, a Muhammad, a Buddha, will come and bring the white light to the planet. The fact is, no, we are the white light. We just haven't collectively put ourselves together to say we're all part of the same spectrum. And when we understand that, then you can't, in understanding this, hurt somebody else, because that's like if I just say to you, take an organ out of your body and throw it away. And you go, what do you mean take an organ out and throw it away? I said, well, we don't like this pancreas. Take it out and throw it away. And it's like, you can't live with that. It won't work. And I say, when we take people and throw them out of the spectrum because we don't like them, they're not part of our group, whatever we are, they have beliefs that totally conflict with who I am, so therefore I don't want them in the spectrum, then you're removing wavelengths from the white light. Every time you do that, there is no white light after that happens. And so the evolution is really the coming together of 7 billion cells, which are 7 billion frequencies, that when collectively come together, return the white light to the planet. So that is the immediate evolution that's in front of us as I see it. But it basically says, then you must understand your unity, that you see yourself as a different human body, but your human body is keyed into a frequency of a white light, the source, and all of us come from that white light source. And this understanding through science will really change the world in which we live.
Well, thank you, Bruce. This is beautiful. And thank you, everybody. Before I tell you what's coming up next week, just a few reminders. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for the series at beyondawakeningseries.com. If you want to learn more about Bruce, please read his books and visit his website, brucelipton.com. You're also invited to go to Terry Patten, TerryPatten.com. Sign up for my personal mailing list and newsletter. And Coming up on Beyond Awakening, I'll be interviewing the remarkable Swiss spiritual teacher Annette Kaiser on August 10th. Other important upcoming guests this year will include Candace O'Denver, Ole Vadum Dahl of Denmark, Tom Steininger of Germany, and Reggie Ray. Thank you so much for joining Bruce and me today. Goodbye, everybody. Thank you.